Hello and welcome to another episode of Screen One for UKFilmReview.co.uk. On this Monday night episode, I will be looking at all the weekend cinema action, which includes the likes of Wind River and Goon, The Last of the Enforcers. But before we get to that, we have a look at movies coming to a screen near you in the not-too-distant future in the trailers. Our first trailer this week is Gypsy Boy, directed by Morgan Matthews, who previously directed A Brilliant Young Mind. And it follows demanding father and a member of the last generation of the Romani Gypsy people, known for their ability to fight. So this might be Fight Club Juniors with gypsies. But no, it is adapted from Mikey Walsh's memoir of growing up in the Romani Gypsy community in the 1980s in England. Benedict Cumberbatch will presumably play his demanding dad, and I know Morgan Matthews will do a very sensitive version of this story, but I can't wait for this movie to be made just so we can get the version of this movie about Irish gypsies. That's the one that needs to be made. Those guys cut epic bare knuckle fight promos that would put anything Muhammad Ali or even WWE have said to shame. There's a gypsy boxer named Christopher O'Donnell that they need to make a movie about. Check this level of charisma right here.
Wanna fight Davey first, then your son John. He's the same age as myself, 34. He's in the prime of his life, I'm in the prime of my life. I have no excuses. I want Davey first, and then John. Oh, let's get it on, Joe, you junkies bastard.
So yeah, any producers listening, this is the only Gypsy Boy movie you should be making. Anyway, our second trailer this week is Black Klansman, directed by Spike Lee, and it tells the true story of an African-American police officer who successfully managed to infiltrate the KKK and become head of the local chapter. I mean, my first thought of this was, I doubt Spike Lee is going to do a kind of white chicks KKK movie. Although, having said that, that movie also needs to be made. My second thought is, this movie is based on a true story, so how the hell did he manage to do that exactly? So I looked it up, and apparently he did most of his correspondence from the phone. But I love this part. He changed his voice and constantly added racial slurs to the end of every conversation, it says here. The thought of that kind of undercover work is pretty hilarious to me. I just imagine him talking in a really redneck accent, even though this actually happened in Colorado, and adding the N-word at the end of every sentence to kind of blend in. Apparently, when he needed to go to the KKK meetings in person, he did actually get the Wayans Brothers makeup artist to help him. Okay, no, he didn't. He sent a white cop in those circumstances. But I like my version better. Our final trailer this week is Terminator 6. Yep, that's right. We are going to spin the magic wheel yet again and try and get a Terminator movie right, which have been so wrong the last four times. I mean, 3 isn't the worst, but it is a massive step down, let's be honest. And every movie after that have been pretty terrible. The only slight glimmer of hope is that Arnie was as good as he has ever been in Terminator Genisys. And that movie was unbelievably bad. James Cameron is back as producer, at least. Arnie will be back, as he often says. It is worrying, though, that Cameron has said this will be part of a three-arc story. I mean, can't we just focus on one story and see if you deserve some more, Mr. Cameron, 26 movies of Avatar, my God. It will be directed by Tim Miller, who did a decent job with Deadpool, so there's that. Okay, those were the trailers. Next up is Screen One.
I need emergency assistance.
What's your location?
The Wind River Indian Reservation.
I'm Jane Banner, FBI.
Welcome to Wyoming.
You by yourself?
It's just me.
That's Corey Lambert. He's the one who found the body.
This is a homicide.
I knew that girl. She's a fighter.
They have six officers to cover an area the size of Rhode Island. Maybe you can help.
I only know what the tracks say.
What is it that you do again?
I hunt predators.
So why don't you come hunt one for me then?
In Screen One this week is Wind River. And listen, I'm not going to lie. I was originally going to review The Vault in Screen One this week. But I looked through the show and a lot of this week's show was just me slating poor movies for the most part. And I know it might seem like it at times, but I do want to be talking about at least decent movies on this podcast. It's a waste of my time to be watching rubbish movies all the time. Although I guess not a waste of your time because you will know what not to watch then, I suppose. But I do want to leave you with at least one movie a week that is actually good to watch. I mean, sometimes the weeks won't permit that, unfortunately. But in the case of Wind River, I didn't get to see it as a screener like all the other movies I normally do. So I went out of my way to see it in the hope that I would at least have one good movie that I would be able to talk about based on other people's reviews, at least anyway. It got a lot of hype. And Wind River is directed by Taylor Sheridan, who wrote the script for Sicario, Hell and High Water. Those movies, along with Wind River, very much were interested in kind of how the old American frontier from the times of the Old West, how they are now in contemporary times, which is certainly a thing I can get on board with, being a big fan of Westerns myself. Now, Wind River takes place on this Indian reservation in Wyoming, a very inhospitable place that is still covered in snow and has blizzards even in spring. Jeremy Renner plays this hunter. Well, I guess he is a wildlife agent and culls predators in the area like foxes and cougars. After he discovers a body while out hunting, an FBI agent played by Elizabeth Olsen arrive, the movie kind of takes the form of this detective mystery investigation from that point on. But it's the kind of detective mystery that takes a different approach, and it's a kind of approach that is really hard to get right. It's a movie that is a lot more interested in how people deal with loss and trauma and the victims of these events and the pain left by those left behind who have to deal with it, I suppose. I mean, you get that firstly in a very thematical way with the setting alone on this Indian reservation, a people still dealing with and feeling the effects of events that happened a few hundred years ago, now living in an environment they naturally wouldn't be living in. So there is the pain of all that in the background, but at the same time, there is a much more tangible representation of it as well in the impact the victims' death has on Jeremy Renner's character and the memories from his past it conjures up. So it's this very grim approach to a detective story. I'm not usually a fan of going to the cinema solely to be made to feel sad, but there are ways to make it enjoyable as well, an enjoyable experience at least. One is having good characters. Now, I wouldn't exactly go as far as to say that Wind River has well drawn out characters you can get behind, but the dynamic between Renner and Olsen is at least serviceable. The dynamic works well, I would say. Elizabeth Olsen is still not an actress I'm too sure on range-wise, but she is cast well in everything I have seen her in so far, and she works well in this as well as this young FBI agent who is an outsider dropped into these harsh elements, struggling to come to terms with her environment. I felt a little bit indifferent to Renner's character, however. He's the only part of this film that seemed to be working against all the other mechanisms. He felt like a different entity entirely, an aloof, almost spiritual figure that almost was on a higher plane of consciousness to everything and everyone else in the movie. And although his backstory does give you reasons for that, when he is dropped into the detective story element of things, it just felt slightly like it was a different movie he was in. Now, as I said, while the characters themselves are serviceable, although well acted for the most part, the overall tone and emotional workings of the piece did get to me quite a bit. So all the elements placed together as a whole did work their emotional web on me, and I too started feeling a sense of sorrow that I couldn't really explain or relate to, because I didn't feel like I was that invested, to be honest, but I did have an emotional response to it, certainly. Now, the biggest thing this movie actually gets right is the detective side of things. It builds to a very satisfying conclusion, despite being a detective story primarily interested in the elements I previously have described. It does pull off the detective side of things excellently, without trying to be too smart or give you cheap twists and thrills. It just builds to a few scenes that are expertly handled in a very procedural way, and in a way that I haven't seen pulled off as well in these kind of movies in quite some time. I do think that in the way the movie does present the chief antagonist, it is needlessly sloppy, though. Every other character seem to be pretty nuanced and well thought out, but by the time we get to the antagonist, I can't really get into it because I don't want to spoil it, but he is properly hamming it up, and it is the only part of the movie where the dialogue felt weaker as well. That's my only gripe, to be honest, but other than that. Wind River is a well-acted, solid detective story that builds and builds and has a few scenes up there with the classic movies of its respective genre.
I've never been a captain before. I hope one day I could be the captain of your dreams. Best wishes, Doug Glenn.
Let's do this! Come on!
Sorry, Mikey.
Shut up, dog.
You want to go?
What's happened to Doug Glatt? It looks like he's in pain on his right side.
She looks like a beautiful tiny mushroom person.
So cool.
New house, baby.
The Highlanders have traded for star forward Anders Kane.
It's my team now.
I need to protect my team.
Have you ever watched a sequel of a film that was so bad that it actually ended up affecting how you felt about the first movie to an extent? Hostel 2 pretty much cheaply undid the good work of the first one with its protagonist anyway. Although I'm in a minority, I guess, in liking the first one quite a lot. Terminator Genesis, as I mentioned earlier, pretty much buried any interest I had in the franchise again. Whoever thought it was a good idea to team up Jai Courtney and Emilia Clarke and expected them to carry a movie hopefully has lost their job by now. Or I would take them out the back and terminate them, but you know. I mean, they got out-acted by Arnie acting as a robot. Then there is sequels like The Matrix that, due to the kind of cliffhanger it left us on, kind of made the first movie seem like an unfinished product that was then ruined by its sequels, although some, again, might disagree. Then there are movies you waited 20 years for a sequel, like Independence Day 2, that, while in no way tarnished the memory of the original, did have Jeff Goldblum driving around in a bus in the film's final act. I mean, come on, who couldn't think of anything better for him to do at all? But maybe, probably not as bad as those examples, but equally infuriating are the sequels that are so far removed from the first film that you don't even remember what it was about the first one you liked so much to begin with. Well, that's kind of how I feel about Goon, The Last of the Enforcers, the sequel to the cult 2011 film directed by Michael Dowse. I mean, a lot of people really like that film. Even people that don't watch film regularly seem to know about it and seem to adore it, and I am certainly a fan as well. However, after watching Goon, The Last Enforcer, most of the time I struggled to remember why I liked the original, and that's not me exaggerating as well, by the way. I watch a lot of films, some stick in my memory and others I just remember were good but can't really remember why. And what at the very least a decent sequel will do is make you remember why. Well, Goon, The Last of the Enforcers follows on from the original Goon, which had Sean William Scott as an underdog who succeeds at hockey, not through his skills, but through his kind of hard man type talent. One thing I remember liking about the original was that it was a sports movie that kind of celebrated the type of player that maybe wasn't the most talented, but certainly put their body on the line and was an asset to the team. I mean, the movie was a comedy, so don't get me wrong. It's not exactly Martin Scorsese's Raging Bull featuring a journeyman midfielder like Robbie Savage or whatever the hockey version of him is. But it certainly celebrated that type of player. And hockey, the way the sport is played, at least in this film, certainly lends itself to that type of player. Now, Goon, the Last of the Enforcers, takes place a few years later and again focuses on Sean William Scott's character, who is now injury-riddled and contemplating retirement. It's a decent premise on paper, but it's hardly the stuff of Rocky. And I think this time, Jay Burchill, who is the director, shouldn't really be let anywhere near the director's seat because he makes a mess of that side of things. And I know he was involved with the writing in the first one, but I would love to know who decided to give him the job this time round, because there is a big gap in quality and it is noticeable. The original had heart. This had none, really. The story is a complete mess and it's not funny at all, really. All these elements are so lacking that it kind of made me wonder, were they in the first one or did the movie catch me on a good day? It would be interesting to go back and see, because like I said, I remember liking the first one, but there is nothing in the sequel that jogged my memory as to why. I am a fan of Sean William Scott, however, I think he's great. It's such a shame, really, that comedians like him or Anna Faris don't get their due. There is certainly a kind of caste system based on what kind of comedies you appear in, and because the movies they have appeared in the past, they don't seem to get the credit they deserve. I mean, check out Sean William Scott in the promotion and tell me he can't hang with the best of them, or Anna Faris in something like Smiley Face. Now, the one saving grace of this Goon sequel, and an actor, anytime he shows up, is usually the high point of any movie, and that is Wyatt Russell. He was in Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some. He was in Folk Hero and Funny Guy. Well, in this he plays a really good bad guy. And he just continues to impress me. He really does. My only issue with him is his look at this moment seems kind of limiting. Like, I can't imagine him without his beard and hair, which lends itself to comedy very well. But I'd love to see how he fits in non-comedy movies, because he certainly appears to have the chops. I mean, Everybody Wants Some wasn't exactly a comedy, but it was set in the 80s with dubious hairstyles and beards aplenty. But yeah, Goon, The Last of the Enforcers, overall a massive, disappointing sequel that I didn't even want to begin with.
Where's the rest of the money?
It's down below. That's where the real money is, in the old vault.
You can get in there?
It's a private vault. It's part of the old bank. We just house it. It's antiquated. It's not even on the grid.
We're not prepared for this.
Well, we're in pretty good shape, I gotta say. We got the cobalt drill bits. We got the welder for the back way out.
Perfect. Then we're going in.
Depends on the vault. How old?
That's 60, 70 years.
We don't have time.
Bullshit! The whole fucking warehouse is up in flames. Everything's locked up. We got time.
How much money's in it?
$6 million, cash.
$6 million?
Bullshit.
No, it's there. At the end of the basement hall, there's a door. The key is here. This is it.
The key. We're in.
As you've probably guessed by now, it's not going to be a good week for movies. It's a pretty poor for releases in general. And I tried to pick the ones I thought had the best chance of being good. I really did. And it was a choice between The Vault and a Hindi comedy called Poster Boys for Screen 3, and I just couldn't bring myself to watch the poster boys. It was over 2 hours long and looked really dodgy. And The Vault is 1 hour, 21 minutes and has James Franco and Clint Eastwood's daughter. So I thought, well, at least it has that. Well, after watching The Vault, I'm not sure if I shouldn't have went with the indie comedy about three men who face ridicule from their families and fellow villagers after they appear on a poster that promotes vasectomies. I don't know, actually. I still don't know which one I should have went with. Anyway, The Vault, directed by Dan Bush, who previously directed such films as Fight, Fuck, Pray, which kind of sounds like it should be seen in a Christian Brothers school in Ireland, but isn't. I mean, that's a very culturally specific joke there, sorry. Although, to be fair, he has another film called The Signal that seems pretty interesting. So, it stars James Franco, who, despite this film being a car crash, is great in it. And I don't know what Dan Bush has over James Franco to make him appear in this. Maybe some incriminating pictures of him appearing in Alien Covenant. But we've all seen it by now, James. But no, seriously. One thing that is consistent with James Franco is that he could actually turn up in any kind of movie, no matter the quality and the budget, and it won't affect his career. He seems to be absolutely immune to it. And you have got to admire his work rate and his readiness to appear in every kind of movie imaginable, no matter how bad. And he has, I think, really improved as an actor in a big way. I mean, I remember criticizing him in a big way in 127 Hours, but I think he's got so much better since then. And I now think he usually does good work whenever he shows up, and he does show up an incredible amount of times. 11 films in 2017 so far, 10 films in 2016, 16 films in 2015. I've excluded all the TV series in that time. I mean, I think this guy has made more movies in 1 year than Daniel Day-Lewis has in his entire career. That's insane. So anyway, The Vault tells the story of two estranged sisters and their brother who decide to rob a bank. But this is no ordinary bank, my friends. Oh no. The two sisters, by the way, are Francesca Eastwood and Tyron Manning, who at least give good performances as well. I mean, Tyron Manning just looks like a meth addict at all times in anything. It's great. So the film starts off perfectly fine in the heist movie kind of way. There is an elaborate setup, and before we know it, the bank is getting held up. All perfectly fine, except somebody somewhere thought the old heist formula needed something more. Someone thought, you know what we don't see enough of? Bank robbery movies that involve ghosts and haunted vaults. Yes, that's right. We get a Ghost Day Afternoon type of movie, and it's just a horrible idea. I mean, it could have been fine. It really could have. But let me just say, firstly, the ghost story is my most hated genre. I hate it usually. I mean, Sixth Sense is probably the only one I really liked I can think of. Ghost stories as a subgenre, I think, are extremely difficult to pull off, as I have mentioned, and I often find them difficult to endure. This is mainly due to the stringent adherence to a convention that needs to be expertly handled in order to work. The mystery needs to be intriguing, the ghost needs to be threatening, and the revelation needs to be worthwhile. The Woman in Black is a perfect example of all these elements coming together to create something that delivers in all those ways? Well, The Vault doesn't have any of this. It has all these ingredients thrown into the plot from the worst of every other ghost story subgenre I can think of, and none of it works. I mean, as a bank heist movie, this would have been okay. If they wanted it to become a kind of slasher ghost movie, it would have been okay. But what they settled on was probably the worst possible thing they could have settled on. But maybe that's me, I don't know. Maybe if you're scared of ghosts and banks, this could be the perfect movie for you. I just don't know.
Pete.
Yeah.
What do you want?
To see you.
How did you find me?
You changed your name. Is that difficult?
It's all right, Pete? Yeah, it's all good, man.
How long have you been married?
4 years.
That poor woman, no idea who she's married to. I don't know anything about you.
You were my neighbor's daughter, not a target.
Where did you go? Why did you leave me?
Ray, can you hear me?
I was a stupid girl with a stupid crush.
In Screen 4 this week, we have Una, directed by Benedict Andrews. It stars Rooney Mara, Ben Mendelsohn, and Riz Ahmed. It is adapted from a play called Blackbird. Yeah, well, this film is a real barrel of laughs, isn't it? It tells the story of Una, played by Rooney Mara, who confronts an older man that is a former neighbor who had a sexual relationship with her when she was 13. The old man is played by Ben Mendelsohn. Now, if you want a three-dimensional version of probably the type of figure who is among the most despised in society, you want that person to be played by somebody like Ben Mendelsohn. So I would say the fundamental thing the film gets right from the offset is in the foresight to cast somebody who just has the ability to even bring a degree of sympathy to pretty deplorable characters. I mean, the late Philip Seymour Hoffman had a similar gift with troubled characters, as does Joaquin Phoenix, and I couldn't help but wonder what a Ben Mendelsohn The Woodsman movie would have looked like had he filled Kevin Bacon's role. Now, the film does a number of things. It treats the relationship between these two central characters honestly and in a true way, or at least in the way that is true to them and their situation. And while the camera shots and my own personal feeling towards such a relationship made me feel uneasy and very uncomfortable, I would prefer we get this conversation between these two characters in all its complexity in a form that feels genuine rather than a heavy-handed, villainous approach of Ben Mendelsohn's character. I mean, he is certainly treated as a fully formed human being, and even a human being that we feel a degree of sympathy towards. Although, of course, we also feel a massive degree of sympathy for Una, now grown up and definitely severely psychologically affected by this relationship she had at 13. But I would much rather have this open, non-editorialized dialogue, leaving it up to us to make our own minds as to how we feel when dealing with this subject this way in a film. Although the camera does underline a very uneasy feeling, it certainly presents it in a very menacing way in the flashback scenes to how their relationship developed. So the director keeps us uncomfortable at the same time. I mean, I don't mind in an action movie Annie busting in the door, shooting a pedophile's head off and saying, "I don't kid around." That stuff is great too. But I really appreciated how Ben Mendelsohn's character is handled, and in the forensic kind of deconstruction of their relationship the two characters have, you're not even sure if he is a pedophile or somebody who fell in love with a 13-year-old girl. It sounds outlandish to say, and I'm certainly not condoning it, but the legal age of consent is 13 in Japan and 14 in places like Germany, Italy and Portugal. So I did appreciate that this film keeps Ben Mendelsohn's motivations ambiguous and leaves it up to the audience in how they feel about this whole thing. Now, one thing I didn't appreciate at all about it, and although I didn't know this at the time, upon learning that it was adapted from a play, it certainly didn't surprise me, because it is a very talky, in a stagey kind of way. One of my problems was, as much as I appreciated the handling of the situation and the two characters, it kind of felt like their dialogue was almost for somebody else, and I'm guessing, as it is adapted from a play, that somebody else was meant to be the audience. So it does create a situation where, in this tension where Una confronts Mendelsohn at work, and he now, having changed his name and got on with his life, he is, of course, worried about being exposed. But some of that tension, while they are having this conversation in a room in private, is undercut by the fact the dialogue feels like it is written in a way for other people to hear it, which is the audience, as I said. It's in that kind of breakfast club way, in this case, the Sex Too Fast Club, as it were. So, I mean, as a film, other than the moments where it finally actually leaves this one setting, which I would be interested to know if that happens in the play, but the moments where it kind of leaves this one location they have been talking in for the film's runtime, when it gets away from there, it feels slightly more cinematic and lends itself more visually, directing-wise too. But for most of its runtime, I can't really justify why this needed to be adapted to this medium. And it doesn't truly work as a character study either, as the dialogue is kind of too stage-orientated to make them feel developed enough. But, you know, if you do want a complex discussion on this subject with two very good central performances, it's worth having a look at. Okay, that was Una, and that brings us to the end of the show this week. Thanks for listening, and if you want to reach me in the meantime, you can contact me at Andy Talks Film on Twitter. That's it for now. Goodbye.